Hello, and welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies. I'm Garrett Brown, the host of the channel. On today's program, I'm speaking with Sarah Rudin about her new translation of Augustine's Confessions, published by the Modern Library in June of 2017. Sarah Rudin was educated at the University of Michigan, Johns Hopkins, and Harvard, from which she graduated with a PhD in classical philology. She has translated 6 books of classical literature and contributed her Aeschylus Orestia to a collection of tragedy in English. Her translation of Augustine's Confessions was her first book-length work of sacred literature. Join me in welcoming Sarah Rudin to the program. Sarah Rudin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Well, not too long ago, we spoke about your book about translating the Bible, and that's The Face of the Water. And we talked about your approach and process in rendering Hebrew and Koine Greek into English. But in your new book, a translation of Augustine's Confessions, you're tackling Latin again. Is Latin the classical language that you move in most often?
Yeah, I was, in my formal studies of classics, I was really a Latinist. So this is the ancient language I know the best.
Okay. And do you have a fondness for Latin over Greek or for other languages? But yeah, I know you've published at least 2 translations from Greek. But how do you think about the differences or the way you approach them?
Okay. Well, I have I'm really attached to Latin. And because I learned it, this was the first ancient language I learned. And, you know, I was close to both my professors of Latin as I was, you know, studying it at Bowling Green State University from the age of 16. And we learned by spoken Latin, as you know, I was telling you before. So it was quite a human experience for me. You know, I learned Latin by talking to people. So I guess it's my attachment to the language is greater for that reason. But certainly there is stunning literature in Latin, just absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. And I remember at Harvard, Professor Wendell Clausen getting indignant at this prevailing idea that Greek culture is loftier. Greek culture is superior. Romans are really just soldiers, jocks, and bureaucrats. And, you know, they couldn't have the sublime literary experiences that the Greeks did. And he thought that was nonsense, and I kind of think that's nonsense, too. Certainly, if you read Virgil, it's difficult to imagine literature being more beautiful, being more resonant.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of literature are you thinking about in specific?
Oh, well, I'm thinking about, say, Horace, the Roman poet Horace. Uh-huh. And, you know, some people think that he's the greatest poet who ever existed. He wrote odes, for example, which are really astonishing pieces of literature, but they're very difficult to translate. They are hardly read in the modern world because he doesn't have, you know, much topical connection to us. He writes about his upper class patrons. He writes about drinking, dancing, and having a good time, and. He has patriotic poetry. It's difficult to connect with him emotionally or practically. So his works, his poems, which are just so utterly perfect in form, just amazing. Documents, they just don't get the attention that they should get, and they're like, you know, I'm wondering whether Jane Austen will suffer the same fate in centuries to come. You know, here you have an author of just perfect style and balance, of incredible technical skill. Yet, you know, she's writing about each time she's writing about two or three families
in
provincial England. And, you know, why is this so wonderful? And because it's in English, we can tell. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you go a couple linguistic removes from her and people are saying, huh, what, you know, what's the big deal?
Mm-hmm. And of course, another stylist is of course, Virgil. And you've translated the Aeneid as well as his eclogues. Is that right? Didn't you start out with the translation of the eclogues?
Yes, I translated, it was three or four eclogues. Anyway, I was very young and they were never published. That was my undergraduate thesis.
Oh, okay. And so were you commissioned by Yale to translate the Aeneid, or how did that come about?
Yes. This was a number of years ago. This was my first, I would say, major translation. You know, I got to a place in my career where I would have to translate something that was really very often assigned for classroom use, or I was going to have to find something to do with my life. You know, the economics of publishing are just really difficult. So we looked around, and this was what I ended up doing. And it wasn't an obvious choice for me because the Aeneid is a great war poem. I'm a Quaker pacifist. So it didn't seem like this was a congenial project for me, but, you know, I ended up with the most tremendous respect for Virgil. The Aeneid is really a great, great document.
Indeed. And the two other things you're known for, the Satyricon and the Golden Ass, both of those probably could be aptly described as ribald. I think one of the things that, you know, there's a lot of humor that's embedded in those work, maybe not so much in Virgil, but how much has that been a part of the challenge of representing the Latin in English?
Well, humor is really difficult. Body literature is also very difficult to render. The things date, so you know, so readily. Jokes notoriously, you know, date within 5 or 10 years. They are just not funny, or most of them are not funny over long stretches of time. Also, the tastes in body literature change tremendously. We are horribly offended by a great deal that we see in Aristophanes, for example, rape jokes. And I have translated Aristophanes' Lysistrata, and that's tough because he goes against so many of our cherished values, particularly, you know, respect for women, for wives, for mothers in particular. He isn't there. You know, he is just his mission is against all pieties. So what do you do with this work to make it not just readable for modern American audience, but stageable? And that's really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had a great deal of fun with my Lysistrata, not so much in writing it, but in sharing it. And first with the Quakers, you know, I gave a reading from it at a Quaker gathering in Africa, and it went over really well because people just liked this idea. Quakers like this idea of, you know, women withholding sex from their husbands until a war ends. And that's that fable, you know, the basis of this play has endured. People do like that idea. You know, they just find their way around the anachronisms. Staging is always interesting, often hilarious. I've only been able to attend, I think, three productions out of 20 or so that have happened. Mm-hmm. And in one of them, this was in Athens, Georgia, a community theater put on the play. And I was able to, I happened to be, you know, in the neighborhood. So I was able to attend the play, and my sister, who lives in Northern Georgia, came along too. And I was really nervous. My sister is very traditional, very religious, you know, devoted wife and mother. What would she think of this bawdy farce? And she laughed so hard that I thought she would choke. because they had, you know, one big question that you have to deal with about staging is you know, how do you render these phalluses? These were a part, an ordinary part of the comic stage costume in ancient Athens. So what do you do with them? This is not something usual to have on a stage in modern America. So they had phalluses, which were just like huge stuffed toys, and they were attached to a sort of hydraulic lift. So the actor discreetly presses a button, and the phallus goes up or it goes down, you know, depending on the lines.
Oh, goodness.
And yeah, that's, now, I know that, you know, some of my readership is traditionally and devoutly religious, and I think that then, for the most part, they've been very open-minded in knowing about my sordid past and accepting that I have, you know, translated some really bawdy literature.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's excellent.
And, yeah. They understand, yeah, this is part of our cultural heritage, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they are not deeply offended when I tell them, yes, there are bawdy verses of the Bible. You know, the dirty joke was not a known to the ancient Jews and to the early Christians.
Right. But if one learns anything from your work, it's really that this much wider reading of the literature of the ancient world helps you to understand the context into which people like St. Paul or the gospel writers are, you know, the world in which they're moving and the kind of literature that's out there. And I think that so over and over again, your work reminds us that this broader possible reading helps you to see what's distinctive in not only Jewish literature, but also the early Christian literature. That's something that I've benefited from, you know, from your earlier work, particularly Paul Among the People.
I think it really helps in being sympathetic to Paul if you imagine him surrounded by pagan imagery of nudity, of sex acts, of athleticism, and the Greeks, you know, competed in the nude.
Mm-hmm.
Something absolutely unknown and unacceptable in Jewish culture. There were actually, you have Hellenized Jewish culture and then some really serious conflicts arise. Say you're a Jewish man is in the diaspora sending his or even in Palestine, you know, wants to send his sons to the gymnasium. So that they will get athletic training, wrestling practice. yeah, so these were the outstanding controversies and points of conflict in Paul's world. And you can just think about his idea of the human person, derived mainly from his Jewish background. And I think you have to construe that he thought that the pagan idea of the person was degraded, brutalized, violent, hyper-competitive. And he's got a very different idea about what a person is. Mm-hmm. And just to maybe cite one instance which would have some modern resonance, there was a real cult of youth in Greco-Roman culture. And you can see it in statuary and in other artistic depictions, also in erotic poetry, the young man, the beautiful nude young man, is put forth as, you know, the highest expression of humanity, the most beautiful thing there is. Well, I think Paul would have said, wait a second, you know, the human body is a thing. It is a perishable thing. And to hold it up as the most desirable thing in the world, and to equate it with divinity, because a nude statue is usually associated with divinity, this is highly problematic, I think you would have said.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think of our media culture, social media culture, advertising culture, and I think, yeah, you know, I really can jive with Paul.
That's interesting. And I see the way in which this broader reading, even with some of the body literature, sort of undergirds, you know, your approach and your sensibility to Augustine, as we'll see, especially as he tackles with some of the, his guilt over past sins or his sensuousness or some of the things that he's tempted to idolatry. Just to go back to an earlier point that you made, I really love this this rivalry between ancient Greece and ancient Rome. I recently heard an hour-long debate between the historian Mary Beard and the former mayor of London, Boris Johnson, where they each took sides. And it's such great fun. I highly recommend it. But, you know, even Augustine himself says that he hated studying Greek, but was infatuated with studying Latin. So, you know, how is it that you perceive, you know, Augustine's own relationship to language that's not Latin, which I understand he was a Latin speaker. Is that right?
Yes.
Right. So would he actually?
Well, that's the consensus.
That's the consensus. So, So would he have been mainly reading in Latin, or would he also have known Greek literature as well, not in translation?
Well, you know, his attitude toward Greek, I think, has a lot to do with his particular circumstances. And he says, he tells us how much he loved Virgil. He really enjoyed the Aeneid. And he said, well, you know, why didn't I like Greek? Because there are fantastical tales in Greek, too. It was because he had to learn Greek in an academic setting. He associates it with getting whomped on by the teacher. He associates it with work, and he didn't come to this language naturally. He didn't like it as much. I think he plays down how good his Greek was. because in a work called On Christian Doctrine, he plays the philologist with Greek scripture. So he's talking, for example, about a New Testament passage and different ways you can read it and how logically you should read it. But he says, of course, you know, we don't get into the scholarly nitty-gritty, or we don't worry about it, because what's important is faith and you know, the church's doctrine. So we don't get all stressed out about the technicalities here. So, you know, his Greek was, I think, quite usable, but it wasn't. This is really important. A short while before his conversion, he gets hold of certain philosophical works in Latin translation.
Mm.
And they are very exciting to him, and he's able to sort of put some reasoning together that led him toward his so-called conversion, this great moment in the garden, when he becomes not a believer, but when he decides to actually dedicate his life to God.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a believer all the time. Anyway, there was something about these translations that he could, there's something about these works that he could access in Latin, but not in Greek.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have had access to the, you know, to the Gospels or the other books of the New Testament in the original languages. It would be through the Vulgate or a proto-Vulgate.
Well, it's very likely that he did have access in Greek. Likely, he did know a word of Hebrew.
Hmm.
That was the that's the major difficulty in dealing with his Bible quotations.
Mm-hmm.
The Old Testament is at two removes from him. So he likes to use Latin work that we call the Old Latin. So this is pre-Vulgate.
Okay.
And so Jeremy is, you know, during Augustine's own time, and in actual communication with Augustine occasionally, Jeremy is working on what will become the Vulgate, or the Standard Latin Bible. You have, before this, you have so-called Old Latin versions. And that they're kind of a crummy, they're really not very good. They're translation of the Bible. They would seem to come from the Greek version. They don't show any access that I can see anyway to the Hebrew. But that seems to be Augustine's go-to Bible,
right.
the so-called Old Latin.
Okay.
And he can go to Greek, apparently, when he wants to. You know, there are lots of his writings that show that he had, you know, some reasonable knowledge of Greek, of the scripture in Greek.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, one question I wondered while I was reading through your new translation was, how much of the biography of the individual helps or hinders or is necessary in the work of translation? Is a good lexicon actually better than a good biography? How do you approach that? I know you mentioned the recent biography by Robin Fox Lane, and of course the venerable Peter Brown should receive a shout out here, but in some ways, we moderns might be more tempted to biography over the confessions, but thinking it would provide a more objective account. But how does it factor in the work of translation?
Right. Well, I'm trying to do something new in translating this in the confessions, which is maybe not the very first autobiography. You know, there are some competitors, a couple competitors for that title, but it is, at any rate, you know, a very, very early autobiography and foundational, seminal, very important for the way that we consider what biography is, how it should be written. Anyway, this is sort of a, this is the okay corral of my work as a translator.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, whenever you work as a translator of ancient literature, you've got to be the avatar of this, try to be the avatar of an author. You got to walk in his shoes. You got to put on his clothes. You have to eat, sleep, and hike him. You know, you got to live this author. So, in the Confessions, you know, this is the author writing about himself, revealing himself, you know, more intimately than, you know, any author has to date. And so he is, but of course he is putting on a mask himself. He is creating this persona for himself, a highly worked, highly literary persona. There is no, I think the word realism is incredibly inappropriate to use of ancient literature.
Right.
It is all an artifice. Everything is created. You know, every sentence is elaborated and shaped to project an idealized person. So that you really can't talk about a historical author. You really have to talk about his artistic self in this work.
Right. Did Augustine have a James Boswell of sorts who can tell us whether or not his literary persona had any relationship to the man in his dealings with others?
No. I think he had absolutely nobody. He was a very solitary person. He had a, you know, group of Christian seekers around him when he was fairly young, around the time of his conversion, and people who lived and studied with him intimately, but several of them died quite young, and we don't hear from any of them. We don't hear, certainly don't hear about him from any of them. He was close to his mother, and she, like nearly all women in the ancient world, left nothing in writing for us. So, yeah, he's on his own.
Right.
We don't have... Okay, Cicero's situation is ideal. So you've got all of these letters of his... which were published posthumously, including a lot of letters he would have suppressed had he had the chance. And you see him as you know, in the center of this political, literary, philosophical group, and you're hearing back and forth about of different ones of them. That's true to a very limited degree when we look at Augustine's letters, so we can see him maybe corresponding with somebody like Jeremy, and we get at least on an intellectual level,
right,
an idea of this back and forth. There are letters.
Okay.
But there's nobody really who would have had any interest in mediating Augustine to us. He mediates himself. And he's got both, you know, tremendous virtuosity in doing this.
Right.
Also, very limited very limited motivation to be actually confessional. If you look in the work for revelations that are really, really embarrassing, you find awfully few of them. So, Confessions is number one. It's a bad translation of the title.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is not confessions, as in going to confession. This is testimony. So you give, this is a testimony you give in public as witness to your faith.
Right.
So
exactly.
Think of the difference between that and confessing a sin to a priest, if you happen to be in the Catholic tradition, and you have that ritual where you go and you tell them the most horrible thing that you've done recently in all detail and in privacy. No, the confession is a public testimony. So what you see there is really odd, especially in relation to our expectations of confession, of confessional literature. Augustine says, okay, well, we were just so horrible. We were little thugs we were, and how hard we were for this town to deal with. We robbed a pear tree of its, ugly and impalatable fruit. We threw it to the hogs. Well, yeah, okay, who cared? The hog farmer, you probably saved the hog farmer some trouble, giving the hogs this food. But he depicts this sin is just burning on his conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets more space than his discarding his long-term mistress, with whom he had a beloved child. He has to split with her. He loves her. He's been faithful to her. She goes back to Africa, and she's gonna be living a retired devotional life herself. He doesn't say this. This really bends my mind. He doesn't say, he said it, felt like his guts were being ripped out, but she is dealt with, that parting with her is dealt with in a sentence or two.
Right, yeah.
Doesn't say anything about what that process was like.
Yeah. It's interesting.
And yet, you get a whole, you get a whole long, prolonged meditative passage about the pear tree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. This character of the work, and that when we approach it through this, this more literal translation of confessions from confessio, it's something you point out, that Gary Wills notes it should be called the testimonies. Peter Brown, makes the point that the Confessions is not a book of reminiscences. They are an anxious turning to the past. And he quotes someone else saying, the note of urgency is unmistakable. And his quote is, allow me, I beseech you, grant me to wind around and around in my present memory the spirals of my errors. And I looked this up in your translation, and it's saying, I'm going to read a little bit more of the context here. For my part, I wanted to plead my humiliations because they glorify you. I beg you, let me, through today's memories, tour the detours of my bygone wrongheadedness and slaughter for you a victim, which is the gift of my rejoicing. This is very, very powerful language. Kind of backward looking, but without the kind of specifics that you've been talking about, that we would expect these embarrassing, admissions, and we're not seeing that, and yet we're seeing an attitude toward the past and perhaps also to the future. Is that your sense of things too?
Yeah, I think that is right. I think it's really important to represent the poetic form of these reminiscences. Because Augustine was a rock star. We have trouble getting our minds around this because, you know, we have a certain idea of who the culture hero is, or who we think the culture hero should be. But in the ancient world, this was a literary man. And somebody who could preach riveting sermons again and again and again, you know, who could take part in public debates about theology. And, you know, he was the go-to guy against heresy in North Africa because he could draw the crowds. And he could defeat his opponent, not just with logical arguments, but with very striking language. This is what he was trained to do from boyhood. It was the main focus of education in those times. You know, a boy would learn to speak and write impressively. That was pretty much the whole of his education.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustine was somebody who rose from the lower middle class, you know, from a very obscure place in the Roman Empire, and you know, got near to the center of power. He was the rhetor. He was the education director of Milan, which was then the center of the empire, and he could have had he not decided on a life of Christian devotion, he could have had pretty high flying administrative career. So he was not, you know, his position was not owing to his piety, his faith, his personal virtue. It was owed to his leadership with words. He could work a crowd like nobody else could.
Hmm.
But when he comes to writing his autobiography, the question in the back of his mind, you know, and the question that his fellow clergy had, you know, concerning the use for this work was, well, you know, what is it doing for our cause?
Yeah.
And that was a fairly shaky cause in that time and place, because I did read in Robin Lane Fox that Donatism, which was not a heresy but a schism, was stronger in North Africa during this period than so-called Catholic, that is mainstream Catholicism. More than the type of Christianity that was sponsored by the Roman state and that was becoming authoritative.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to. It was like a football game. You know, they had to win the Heisman Trophy of Christian doctrine, or they were going to face being forgotten. Other people were going to determine what Christianity would be for the future. And this was, I mean, the contest with Donatism was just fundamental. If the Donatists had won, our Christianity would be just, I think, unrecognizable.
Hmm.
Because the Donatists said that the priests who, you know, during this last climactic persecution, the priests who, you know, were not faithful in hanging on to and defending the scriptures that they had, you know, they didn't turn these books over. They were those were the only real Christians. So clerical authority depended on not on grace, but on conduct.
Right. It's fascinating. And I'd like to get back to this question of style, because in some ways it really is what accounts for the popularity of the Confessions over the years, is something that we return to again and again. And mm-hmm. there are two quotations I'd like to read. One is from Peter Brown, but then another is from the introduction to your translation. And they both kind of have a nice response to each other. The first is from Peter Brown: "Our appreciation of the Confessions has suffered from the fact that they have become a classic. We tend to accept or dismiss them according to our own standards, as if Augustine were still our contemporary. In paying Augustine this compliment, we forget that a late Roman man who first opened the copy of the Confessions would have found them a startling book. Traditional forms of literary expression that he had taken for granted would flow into it, only to be transformed beyond recognition." And so the style question, which your book and your introduction and your translation speaks into, is you set out at the beginning that in this work, Augustine usually performs his relationship with God. His account of it is crammed with puns and other wordplay, alliteration, clever allusion, abrupt self-correction, whimsical digression, and self-deprecating rhetorical questions. He even bases figurative language on the feminine gender of certain nouns in Latin and their pronouns, depicting himself as erotically repelled by or attracted to an absent quality or a general situation, as if it were a woman. And that sort of nicely summarizes some of these questions of style, which I think really give us a sense of personality, even though maybe there's a lack of autobiography that we expect to find in it, but it is very much part of the voice that comes across on its pages, even over the gap of years.
It is just really impossible. It's impossible to overstate Augustine's genius. He's like the Da Vinci of his age. He's like the Isaac Newton of literature, because the stuff that he manages to pull off, and the material out of which he fashions this great work, is just it's mind boggling. He's got to work with in terms of both style and content. What's really prestigious for him to work with, and what will really impress his readers who have some education at least, is pagan. It's this highly wrought style. It's pagan literature himself, and you can see echoes of Virgil throughout the Confessions. But he has renounced his education and his early profession as a teacher of rhetoric. He's saying, this is useless. This showboating for the law courts, and this is how anybody makes a name for himself. You argue cases in the law courts, and you have there's also this literature that's just for show. You give encomiums to the emperor. There's that kind of thing going on, and he says, it's just worthless, and I've turned my back on it. Well, yeah, but he uses the fundamentals of it for the rest of his life in promoting Christianity. But the thing that he has to work with, and he has to work with very great respect and deference, is the old Latin scripture, which is, with all respect, a bag of hammers. As a teenager, he was unimpressed with it. He thought it was clunky. He thought it was silly. He thought it was, he didn't, you know, the content himself didn't impress him, you know, in particular, this image of God as, you know, acting like a person and acting, you know, acting differently according to, you know, different circumstances. And, you know, the Manichaeans got a lot of mileage out of that. This is the dilemma he's in, and this is the circle that he manages to square, the square he manages to circle. You know, this guy, from his boyhood, he loves Latin literature, and he's going to be a literary star, and he does make it, you know, against the odds. You know, he's really getting up there in this literary profession of his. But this whole tradition is pagan. It takes, you know, in Latin, it takes absolutely no account of Christianity whatsoever, because there isn't even an original scripture there in Latin. He has to, at least on the surface, he's got to renounce all of that. He's wasted his time. He spent his life deplorably up to now in this worldly, frivolous pursuit. But it's the only thing he has to give to a Christian life. Mm-hmm. It turns out this is the only skill that Christendom is interested in. He tries other stuff. You know, he kind of he tries to be a contemplative. He tries to be a philosopher, but he doesn't have. I think this is evident over the whole of his works. You know, he doesn't have, you know, synthetic, riveting ideas about theology. He is, you know, dragged out of his contemplative community because he is the speaker that the church needs. The speaker and the writer that the church needs.
Well, let's turn our attention to a specific passage in your translation to see what you're doing, maybe different from what people are familiar with from other translations. One that you mentioned was the encounter with the drunken beggar. What was the episode, and what are you illuminating in your translation here?
Okay. This is, let's see, book 6, chapter 9.
9 and 10, or is it? Yeah. So 146, I guess.
145, starting on 145. Yeah. And, going on in the actual, on 146. We meet this beggar. Yes.
So what happens?
Okay. Should I read some of this?
Sure, absolutely.
To the friends who were with me, I moaned in speaking of the many sufferings of our own insanity. In all our kinds of effort, like the effort straining me so badly now, when my longing sharply prodded me to drag along a load of my own unhappiness that was heaped up higher with the exhaustion of dragging it, we didn't want anything but to reach a state of carefree enjoyment. That beggar had beaten us to it, and perhaps we were never going to arrive. Toward what he'd achieved already, which was evidently the enjoyment of a strictly time-bound happiness, with just a tiny handful of small change he'd panhandled, I was taking a woefully winding course, advancing myself by paths that circled back on themselves. He didn't have true joy, but I, with all my bids for advancement, was in quest of something much less real. He was enjoying himself, no doubt about it, while I was in distress. He was carefree, while I was shaking in my shoes. And if anybody had asked me whether I preferred dancing for joy or feeling terrified, I would have answered dancing for joy. If, on the other hand, someone had asked me whether I preferred to be a person like him or a person such as I was then, I would have chosen to be myself with all the worries and fears that overwhelmed me. So there's something in Latin called the, in late Latin called the pointed style.
Uh-huh.
And so you have lots of antithesis, lots of little cute riffs. So you take one idea and you just go to kind of spin it out endlessly and endlessly. And he is doing this concerning the beggar. Is it man that he sees in the street who seems to epitomize for himself, epitomize for Augustine the ridiculousness of his situation. This homeless guy, this bum, is happier than he is.
Yeah, and then you go on page 147 to emphasize. I love this paragraph. Would you read the one that starts, "It does make a difference"?
It does make a difference where someone gets his joy. I know, and the joy of faithful hope is incomparably far from that fatuous ambition of mine. But even at the time, that beggar was far ahead of me, hardly surprising as he was happier, not only in that he was flooded with cheerfulness, whereas I had anxieties tearing at my insides. Through a few polite words of well-wishing, he'd obtained his wine, while with my lying, I was still seeking swollen-headed self-delusion. So lots of alliteration there.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, now you see how self-deconstructing
mm-hmm.
this discourse is. It's amazing. You know, he is the reason that the sight of the beggar has upset him so much, you know, in his account, is that, you know, he was rehearsing or frantically composing an encomium to the emperor. So this was a, you know, big chance for him. You know, he was gonna be praising to the sky mendaciously this secular autocrat. This is going to be his big break, but only if he didn't blow it. You know, he had to give a perfect speech. So he's going nuts about this, and then he sees this beggar who, according to him, doesn't have a care in the world. So he expresses this height of frustration. You know, here I am. I've got all these opportunities and all these hopes, and I wouldn't really want to be this guy. Want to be me, but yet it's agony to be me, to be a redder. And so, this is a significant moment, and a few more moments like this, and he is in the garden, and he is dedicating himself to a Christian life, giving up rhetoric. But he tells the whole story in very elaborate rhetoric.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is nothing monastic, there is nothing plain, there is nothing clerical about the style of the story. So he gives up rhetoric, and he keeps it.
Right, right. He talks about that earlier in book one, where he really is bowled over by the rhetoric of, like, on page 29. He talks about his early influences, and he said the men who were set before me to imitate were devastated if scolded for divulging with some foreign impropriety in pronunciation or a mistake in grammar any innocent action of theirs. But if they told their lustful indulgences faultlessly with pure and flowing diction, eloquently and elaborately, they would preen with the flattery accorded them. You know, so it's all this attention to form, and yet without any reference to the moral content. I found that striking, mm-hmm. and also a kind of reflection of our own modern situation, looking at a lot of modern literature, looking at the dominance of form versus content.
Yeah, but you know, modern literature and form has really got nothing on ancient literature. Yeah, mm-hmm. Content won.
Yeah.
It won decisively. It didn't in ancient literature. It's I would say nearly always an equal partner. Form and content are generally equally important and bound together.
Right. I'm thinking of the ones who are much more playful with the games of language, like Joyce or Nabokov. But in any case, he doesn't let go of it. He doesn't let go of those things as you're saying. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, he has this. He has a rather ambivalent attitude, I would have to say. You know, he is in explicit terms, he is right where he's supposed to be in his theology. And it says in the confession, you know, I could master this very difficult work of Aristotle, you know, gave me no trouble at all. All my classmates were just stumped, but I was fine. I got it, and he keeps coming back to that. It was worthless. All my virtuosity was worth nothing, and it's actually better to be a little guy, one of the little people of the church, who know nothing.
Yeah.
But they are faithful, and they accept the church's doctrine as it's given to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get. They don't have the temptation to explore mm-hmm. or to get prideful, to get puffed up with their learning. So I was way worse off. You know, it took me so much longer, and it was so much more dangerous for me because I thought I knew things, and I thought I was just really good at things and could, you know, argue away. So it's better to know nothing. But, and this is what doesn't get said, but it's plain on every page. But, you know, once you know something, once you have these skills, you can't go back. You can't unknow mm. what you know.
Yeah.
You can't undo the style that you've worked full time to develop over 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly wish we had more time to explore some of the other passages that... you so beautifully render in English, especially the whole episode with Monica's death. But at the end of our program, we traditionally ask, what is it that you're working on now?
Oh, well, I am working on a new translation of the gospel. So that's probably going to take me a couple years now.
Okay.
But I am already at that with very great excitement. And, I have, there's a preview available if people would like to see it. If you go to sarahrudin.com on the internet, there's a section on my website called Gospels Translation Preview. And I talk about a passage in Mark. The passage in which Jesus meets the Syro-Phoenician woman, and he ends up, it looks like, insulting her. You know, he says, "Your people are dogs, and I'm here to feed the children." And she replies, "Well, even the dogs, you know, get to eat what the scrap under the table." And what to me is particularly interesting about this passage is it doesn't say dogs. It says little doggies.
Yeah.
It's a word. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean puppies. It doesn't mean simply small dogs. It means little doggy poos. It's a word from comedy. it's a word from, you know, quite lowly literature, and it's slangy and very likely funny.
Hmm.
And that's the word that he throws at her. She throws it back at him, and he seems to be delighted, and he immediately grants her daughter a hearing. It changes the whole tone of the passage.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from, you know, the standard translations show him being insulting. He sounds more teasing.
Mm.
In a correct translation, and she goes right along with them. So it becomes a just surprisingly intimate, rather tender exchange.
Yeah, it's
and
it's
of course the woman. Oh, go on, sorry.
Oh, it's just one of these things that I think really the humor of Jesus is often flattened out in a number of, you know, the committee translations. And we just miss it because some of it is sarcasm or this kind of back and forth banter. And, you know, it's underappreciated, I think.
Yeah. You know, I really have to deplore, though I understand, the caution of translators who, you know, looking at a word like, you know, Cunaria, little doggies, say, well, I just can't make Jesus say little doggies. You know, I thought of your word flattened out. Your term for this is, I think, exactly right. Translators have the best motivations. And they are being respectful, but what they do in the end is they take the personality and the emotion and the drama out of sacred literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that sacred literature does not gain by that.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
It doesn't, yeah. Well, I for one, very much look forward to your forthcoming translation. But in the meantime, I recommend to our listeners Augustine's Confessions, available from Modern Library in June of 2017. So thank you, Sarah, for your time, and perhaps we'll have you back on when the translation comes out.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been lovely.
That concludes my conversation with Sarah Rudin about her new translation of Augustine's Confessions, published by the Modern Library in June of 2017.